Hey guys, it's Albert. We're going to open things up by clearing up a few misconceptions about the NFL's offensive revolution that we were all talking about in September and October and where it's going forward. Then Jenny and Connor come in for the news. We're going to have a little O.J. Simpson mentioned in there too a little later in the podcast. And as always, we wrap things up with a six-pack of your Twitter questions. Let's go. All right, welcome back in. Week 14 is in the books. It's the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. And we're going to kick things off here by talking about something that we talked a lot about in September and October, and where I think a lot of people went a little too far. And I know everyone out there has heard for probably 2 or 3 months now about the offensive revolution in the NFL. And there's a lot of that that I think is incredibly valid. I think it's valid, the idea that NFL coaches are more open-minded now than they've ever been before. I think that's led to a lot of college stuff coming to the NFL and making the game more exciting. I also think players are coming to the NFL because they grow up playing 7-on-7, because they're throwing the ball more at the high school level and into the college level. Players are coming in to the NFL more capable of playing in these wide-open schemes, and it's just it's led to the game being played in a different way. All of that's true. I think the teams are going to be more creative in looking for offensive coaches. I think the rules have had an effect on everything. Again, all of that's true. Here's where I think everybody's gone too far, and here's where I think we have proof of it. I think everybody's gone too far in saying that the run game doesn't matter anymore, defense doesn't matter anymore, stopping the run doesn't matter anymore. All you have to do is be able to throw it all over the yard. All you got to do is find the next Sean McVay, get a quarterback, and you're good. I think what we've seen the last few weeks is that the old formula still works and that you can be creative in other areas of the game. Creativity isn't limited to the offensive passing game. And if you want to look and see what's happened over the last 2 weeks, you can find the Cowboys shutting down the Saints offense in large part because they were able to slow the game down with their running game and win with their defense. We saw the same thing with the Bears playing the Rams, and weather played into this, but the Bears playing the Rams on Sunday night. And the Bears being able to kind of take that game into a dark alley and see who is tougher. And so, and I'll bring Jenny and Connor in now. Like, I think it's a good example of what we'll probably see at some point in January and the challenge for the teams that are like the Chiefs. And I think the Saints is to me, it's to a lesser degree because I think they've got more. I think they're more well-rounded. I think they've got better defensive players. I think they've got a hammer of a running back in Mark Ingram and are capable of playing that style. I think for the Rams and the Chiefs, there are challenges coming. Like, and I think it's going to be, do they run into one of these teams that's going to want to play a certain style, and are they going to be capable of winning that style? I've always felt like the idea that defense wins championships, I don't think was ever quite correct, even 20 years ago. I don't think it was ever quite correct. I think it's the team that has the most answers, the team that can win the most amount of ways, because eventually, this is the way it works in the NFL, eventually you're going to run into somebody who can take away what you do well and that can make you play a different way. And if you're one-dimensional, you're eventually going to get exposed. And so, to me, especially like you look at the Chiefs, no more Kareem Hunt. And like, so, you know, now do they need Patrick Mahomes to be Superman week to week to win? The Rams, are they capable of morphing? And we know Gurley's capable of taking over games, but are they capable of turning into a power running team if they have to become a power running team? Are they capable of covering up their holes on defense? I think as excited as we all got about those teams in September and October, and as eager as I think a lot of people were to talk about this being like the front end of a revolution, I think we took that a little too far.
You know, it's interesting. I was talking to Wade Phillips a couple weeks ago in Los Angeles, and it was after they had played the Chiefs, you know, after, of course, the high offensive explosion game. And his point was that, you know, now is the time of year when defenses are really hitting their stride because they're getting more and more used to seeing a lot of these different concepts. And so his opinion was that we are going to see sort of a surge in defense the last several weeks of the season because they had gotten used to some of these different shifts, some of these different concepts. The more and more you see them, the better you get at recognizing them and being able to defend them well. And I think, you know, we're sort of starting to see that. The other factor is the cold weather, right? So, you know, offenses when, you know, now, of course, you know, if you're playing in Los Angeles, you're playing in a dome, that's not a factor. But, you know, Sunday night in Chicago, it's cold. And, you know, it's the kind of situation where, you know, different offensive concepts are more successful in cold weather than in warm weather. But it is interesting because, like you said, I mean, the Rams have Gurley. They play under center a lot. Like, they're one of the highest teams under center. So, you know, if you had asked me, you know, going into that game, I thought the Rams were going to win. And I felt like, you know, in the cold, they have the back to be able to thrive. And the Bears defense just was able to stifle the run plays before they even got going.
But I think there's also like a comfort level you have in playing that type of game. And they haven't been in a lot of those. Like, even like, I think the closest thing you probably find to those sorts of games probably for them would have been like the Denver game, right? Like, I think the Denver game was probably an example of that. And even that one was played in the 20s, I think. There was the game against Seattle, I think at Seattle, the one that came down to converting the fourth and one, and that one was like 33-31. So I think there's also like a level of comfort in playing that sort of game. And the Bears, I mean, they look like they were in their element playing that sort of game. The Rams didn't look comfortable playing in that kind of game.
Yeah. I think the whole thought on the offensive revolution thing is, I think it depends on how you define it. And everybody had sort of a different idea of what that really meant. And to me, what the offensive revolution meant was in 2 years or 3 years, and I still think this is true, you know, what we saw between the Chiefs and the Rams is not going to become less attractive to owners. That is still what they want. You know, that is still what fills stadiums, and they're still going to try to replicate that this offseason and next offseason. And to me, what the offensive revolution meant was that we're going to start just seeing the league kind of go in two different ways. Teams that can successfully replicate that to some degree, and teams who fail miserably trying to replicate that by making bad hires or spending incorrectly in free agency or something like that. And so I think what we saw last night was not really a counterweight to that, but just, you know, this sort of an undercurrent to what's been happening all along, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I just think of, like, it's weird because I look back at like Super Bowl 25, right, and Super Bowl 36 are the two games that I sort of look back at as like the best examples of like how you beat a great offense, right? And the way the Patriots did it against the Rams in 2001 and the way the Bills did it against the Giants, or the way the Giants did it against the Bills in Super Bowl 25, like, both those games were, all right, like, let's shorten the game. Let's take their offense off the field for long periods of time. I don't, like, it almost makes it not matter how good you are offensively when you're playing that way. You know what I mean? Like, if you're capable of putting together 12 play, 14 play drives, and like the Seattle didn't score a lot last night or on Monday night, right? Like, they didn't score, but they were totally in control of that game because they were keeping the Vikings off the field, you know? And not that the Vikings are this high-flying offense, but you can see the formula at work there.
Well, I should say that too. I mean, defenses should be catching up now that they have this type of sample size. Like, if you look at that Patriots game against the Rams in the Super Bowl, that was one of the true victories of coaching, of game planning.
Right.
Of, you know, back then, you know, technology was still on binders, you know, and they had to collate it to dubbed VCR tapes and stuff like that. Right now, Wade Phillips can have an intern or his defensive backs coach pull up the last 12 games of the Rams, sort it 80 different ways, and say, okay, well, this is, or, you know, whoever they're playing, the Bears, and say, okay, well, this is where they're weak. This is how we beat them. You know, this is their Marshall Faulk that we got to beat up behind the line in the Super Bowl. And I think that now we're seeing, we also have a good sample size now on these teams, and that's a big part of it too.
Yeah, it's like you said, like, Jenny, your point about Wade, it's, you can be creative. I mean, you see what the Ravens are doing with the run game now. Like, that's creative. Like, it may not pop like the way a great, like, what the Chiefs are doing in the passing game does on TV, but what the Ravens are doing with their run game with Lamar Jackson is really creative. And some of the things you see defensively, and I think the Bears would be a good example of this, because the Bears really seem to have Jared Goff on the run. Like, he didn't know what he was looking at for parts of that game. And Vic Fangio in certain ways, like, daring them, like, okay, like, we don't think you're going to commit to the run. We don't think you're going to play that way on us. So we're going to be able to mix coverages. It's the idea that like creativity is because we can, I think it's because you can like visually see the creativity more on TV, right? Like if a team's creative in the passing game, it's like easier to see that. Like that doesn't mean there's not space for coaches to be creative in the way they run the ball, to be creative in the way they play defense.
Yeah, I think Baltimore is a perfect example of that. Yeah. You know, I think that, you know, drawing from everything, from different option concepts, all that kind of stuff to get that offense move. I mean, they almost beat the Chiefs this weekend.
Yeah. You know? All right, so we'll get to the news now. And actually, we got one dropped in our lap this morning. News item number one, the Minnesota Vikings fell to the Seattle Seahawks on Monday night, 21-7. We referenced that game a couple of times here. And in the aftermath, I want to say, what, like 12 hours maybe after the final gun, the Minnesota Vikings fired offensive coordinator John DeFilippo. You may know his name. He's, of course, been considered one of the top coaching candidates. Did a great job last year as the quarterback's coach of the Eagles with Carson Wentz first, then Nick Foles. He's fired. The quarterback's coach there in Minnesota, Kevin Stefanski, takes over. You may remember his name because the Giants were trying, they hired Pat Shurmur. Shurmur wanted to bring Stefanski to New York to be his offensive coordinator. They blocked him, and the Vikings felt like we need to hold on to Stefanski because we may only have DeFilippo for a year because he may become a head coach, so they were grooming him to be the offensive coordinator. Obviously, it didn't play out the way that they thought it would exactly, but the result is now they've got the guy that, you know, they believed would be their future offensive coordinator in that role. And I mean, man, the Vikings are 6-6-1 because the NFC playoff picture is so muddled. They still have a shot to get in. This is gonna be Mike Zimmer's fourth different offensive coordinator in 5 years. I'm just opening it up to you guys. Like watching last night, like it seemed to me watching their offense looked broken. And it seemed, and watching him the week before against New England, Dalvin Cook was fantastic, but wasn't getting the ball very much. Like it seemed to me like there's this disconnect there. Zimmer was sort of public about criticizing Flip, and so yeah, I just want to open it up to you guys. Like, does this give the Vikings a chance? Does this change anything? Like, where does this go?
I mean, the baffling part about the Vikings is they have a lot of talent. Like, yeah, on paper, they, you know, should have been back where they were last season. And so I think those frustrations clearly contributed to the move. And you're right, you know, Zimmer sort of hinted at this the last week. You know, it's interesting, like the mid-season coordinator change, it's sort of hard to know exactly how it will go because you don't know how the new coach will approach it, right? Like in Cleveland, we've seen it, like Freddie Kitchens, who we didn't know much about, right? Like he's really sort of transformed that Browns offense and he had, you know, the time and the ability to do it. Now you're sort of making this change with what we have, 3 weeks left.
Yep.
So, you know, how quickly can you, how much can you change in that condensed time period?
Well, the model, I think, would be Baltimore, where they fired
Cam Cameron, right?
Yeah, they fired Cam Cameron. Jim Caldwell took over.
In like late December, mid-December, something
right,
like that.
And it was right around now, and I think it was sort of the same thing then, that like they felt like under Cam they lacked an identity. And God, it's crazy to even say this name now, but you know, it was like, all right, like we need to build, our defense is starting to play better. We need to center the offense more around Ray Rice. And it worked.
Right.
I think that's probably an outlier. Like I think normally these things happen when a season's, like you said, circling the drain. And so if Zim had determined that this was not going to work, the makeup of that team, like, I don't mind them going for it now, like, because if they can get in the playoffs, it's not impossible.
Well, they're still the sixth seed, you know.
Yeah.
They're still, and so I think there's two things to kind of consider here. I think one is that Mike Zimmer, you know, one of the reasons that it took him so long to get a head coaching job, but maybe one of the reasons he's so beloved now, is he's not your classic pragmatic CEO type.
Yeah.
He's the kind of guy that can see a game like that in Seattle yesterday and say, screw this, and,
yep,
you know, I'm doing what I want, and we're making a change. But I think, to Jenny's point, you know, I had talked to a coach who had been through this a couple weeks ago, and the Bengals fired Terrell Austin, and you know, when you fire a coordinator, there's so many little administrative things that get passed down to different people in the organization. And, you know, are these people that can handle different things? Are these people that can this guy run a meeting? I mean, all this stuff you find out on the fly in week 15 when you're the sixth seed in the NFC playoffs. And so, like you said, you know, Freddie Kitchens, I mean, maybe this can work. But I would argue that there's not the same pressure on him with the Browns sort of out of the playoffs by the time that move had been made anyway. I mean, Stefanski, you know, this is a golden opportunity, but at the same time, nobody's going to care that you've only had three or four games to do this. They're going to say you have an $84 million quarterback, you have Adam Thielen, you have Stephon Diggs, you have Dalvin Cook, and why aren't you getting this done?
Right, and it's also, to be fair, Jim Caldwell had been a head coach. Like, when that happened in Baltimore in 2012, I mean, Jim Caldwell had coached a team to the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a young coach who's very well thought of, well thought of enough where Pat Shurmur wanted to bring him to New York, and Zimmer couldn't lose him, you know, where they blocked him from coming, and so he's very well thought of. Yeah, I mean, the other thing is, like, Jenny, this puts pressure on everyone in the building too. You know, like I think it puts pressure on Zimmer himself. I think it puts pressure on the quarterback because the quarterback is, you know, again, the $84 million man who hasn't played very well. That offensive line hasn't played very well. I think it puts pressure on everybody, and you don't know. It's hard to say how everybody's going to react to it.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what it sort of signals, is that everyone's sort of feeling the heat of the team, like, regressing in a big way from last season, right? I mean, so you take a team that was one game from the Super Bowl, and then you get what's happened this season, and I think, you know, Zimmer clearly is feeling pressure to make this change, right? To have a better outcome to the season. And I don't know exactly what that pressure is, but he's definitely feeling some kind of pressure to, you know, get the season back on track. You know, the other interesting thing is, like, when an offensive coordinator is fired, what was the issue, I think, is important to determining if they will be successful or not. Was the scheme a total failure, or was the person a bad play caller? You know, I've heard plenty of situations where someone would freeze and they wouldn't know, and they'd get overwhelmed in the moment and couldn't pick the right play. Was that the issue? And maybe Stefanski is more equipped in that situation, or maybe he's inexperienced and he's going to have the same struggles calling the plays. And so, because you can't change scheme all that much at this point in the season,
so
right?
This just happened, so I don't want to, like, draw any conclusions, but my sense is that this was probably more philosophical, and we've all seen this before with defensive head coaches, right? Like, my sense is that this is probably more, we've got a great defense, we don't need you trying all that hocus pocus, we don't need you going three and out, we need you to run the ball, to shorten the game, and to protect our defense. Like, I think that that's probably a piece of this, where for Mike Zimmer, it's like, I want the defense to be the center. And you guys covered Rex Ryan, so you guys know what this is. You guys know what this can be
it's
about.
It's always a 2010 Jets
it
reference.
It always comes back to Rex.
But the way defensive coaches typically want their teams built, like,
right.
And that's what Zimmer wants.
That,
is like,
no, that and that was the big conflict of the 2011 season, right? Because Rex wanted the ground and pound, and Shoddy wanted to open up the offense and pass it, which is why the Seattle situation this year is really interesting, because that's sort of what they wanted all along in New York. You know, now we're on a tangent, but
can I just say that, speaking of that, and, you know, you saw it a little bit on the sidelines yesterday, where there are people kind of getting upset at one another. You know that when something like that happens, there's an issue. But I think it's not funny if you're in the building, but from, you know, 30 feet above looking in, the passive aggression that happens in times like this. Like, you talk about the Jets at that time, when, wasn't it the off season when Rex allowed everyone to quote unquote bring in a mentor, but it was really like, here's Tom Moore overseeing Brian Schottenheimer to kind of, like, fix the offense in some way, shape, or form. And, like, when Rex had Marty Morningwig, you know, he wanted Marty Morningwig to do something, and Marty got mad and they ran the ball 50 times against the Dolphins one game, you know. And just, I think that when stuff like that happens, the Vikings aren't letting it get to that point, which is which is
I think good. It was pretty yeah. close, though.
It was close, but it was close. Not like openly yeah. passive-aggressive. Yeah.
But it's a good comparison because it's always the question of, I remember Trevor Price said when Rex Ryan got hired, his first question for him was, who's your OC? And it's the same question when you have a defensive-minded head coach. It's always like, who's the OC? And are the styles going to match? And is there going to be frustration? And it was clear from the outside that there was frustration.
No question.
I think that the one thing before we move on that everybody needs to know about, you know, having an offensive coordinator, you have to trust your quarterback. What do we learn from Friday Night Lights season one finale? Coach Mack, the offensive coordinator, didn't know what play to call, asked Matt Saracen, hook and ladder, Panthers win state. So just put more on Kirk Cousins,
hook and ladder.
A hook and ladder, yeah.
Yep. Speaking of hook and ladder, or is that not the
well,
first one?
Well, let's just
transition into that one.
Let's
then.
Make it look okay. like I did that on purpose.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. I didn't know if I had that up first, but yeah, we can call an audible here.
The Miami Dolphins won their fifth home game in six tries against the Patriots in the most outrageous fashion, scoring on a hook, ladder, and pitch to Kenyon Drake. The 69-yard touchdown gave the home team a 34-33 win. Our producer Harry is wearing a Dolphins shirt, perhaps to
commemorate. That's the old logo too, which I'm in favor of.
Shirt. Yes, yeah. I agree with the old logo, perhaps to commemorate the what are they calling it? Yeah. The Miami Miracle.
Miami Miracle.
See, isn't that Doug Flutie though? You can't use that again, can you?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's a lack of imagination with play names. We just use the same things over and over again.
City name and synonym
miracle
for amazing.
Or something. Yeah, yeah, Miracle at the Meadowlands, right?
That's just one. I feel like that's just like when they can't think of something better.
The last successful, I think, if I did my research right, the last successful relay like that to end the game was the Saints in 2004, and it's called the River City Relay because it happened in Jacksonville, I think it was.
Is that right?
But they lost the game because they missed the extra point after tying it on the
How do I
game.
Not remember that?
2004, Aaron Brooks.
That's
come
crazy.
On, baby.
So yeah. So then Jim Haslett would have been the head coach?
Jim Haslett was there, yeah.
Yeah.
But I thought, I wrote like it's just a short appreciation of this after the game because I mean, how great is a play like this? Like you can watch it 600 times in slow motion yeah. and, you know, Bill Belichick put it on him after the game and Rodney Harrison said that he should have known better because they practice this every day and they know the decision.
Oh, but, it's totally on Bill. We'll get to that.
It is totally on Bill. I mean, you shouldn't put a sputtering
I mean, like all right,
29-year-old Rob Gronkowski yeah. back there as your last line of defense. But that being said, forget all that. I mean, you can't devote a lot of practice time to this play or these plays because you wouldn't be a responsible coach
right.
if you were doing that. And that's why I think that this is one of the best plays in football because it's purely playground. It's like it's kill the man with the ball. It's like just toss it all over the place.
So where does it rank for you
in terms of greatest plays?
Yeah, like the greatest game ending plays. Is it better than the Fail Mary?
I will say this.
I think the Fail Mary had more legs because of the ref lockout.
Yeah.
You know
the
what I mean?
Like circumstances really bolstered that.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, because I think the circumstance, like, I don't think this will have the legs that had because that was just, like, played right into the ref thing. And
right.
So that would be a good one. Like you said, the River City Relay, which I, for some reason, cannot remember. There have been a bunch in college, too. Like, the one that Kenyon Drake was actually there for. Was
the fiesta, yeah,
the kick six against the Auburn Alabama
yes.
game?
Yes, oh. yes.
So, I was gonna say the
Boise
okay,
State,
so,
yeah.
So that's essentially this one does have like those tentacles. Boise is obviously taken from the Boise State play in the Fiesta Bowl, and then Kenyon Drake, the guy who scores the touchdown. I actually tweeted a picture of it yesterday. I found I went back and I looked at the kick six, and if you look when they zoom in on the Alabama kicker before he kicks it. Like you see in the background, like Kenyon Drake standing there on the sidelines. And so
that's cool.
That's a good name. Kick six is, I think kick,
I agree.
Six,
kick six, six is
I,
good.
Kick
I
six
think,
is good.
I think that one might, like that one is going to be hard to top.
The kick six?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because
it was so, because that one's like a weird rule,
totally,
quirk.
Totally.
You know,
quirky in the nature of the rivalry, just yeah. everything.
And then it happened in a huge rivalry
exactly.
game.
Exactly.
Like
yeah.
it had an impact on. I believe it was at 2013, I think. So it may have kept Alabama. You know what? It kept Alabama out of the national championship game. Auburn went to the national title game, I believe, that year. because so the stakes, I think,
the stakes were just higher.
Another good one that a friend of the pod mentioned to us on Twitter. I'll try to get his handle up if I can find it by the end of this. Was so back in 1982. So Albert, you were what, 16? The Dolphins Chargers ended in, that was the first really epic
game.
This is pre-Marino, like super epic. I think it was one of the best. One of the best games of the 80s, okay. Like Dolphins versus Eric Coryell and all that kind of stuff. And the Dolphins won on like an epic hook and ladder, which was sort of like the basis for some of what we saw later on, like in Boise and everything like that. So I think that one deserves to be mentioned in terms mm-hmm. of, you know, obviously with you being the only one around to see that.
Yeah. Do you guys remember the Cordell Stewart at Michigan?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you guys are old enough for that one.
Yeah. That,
one,
that was 94.
Yeah. And that was Cordell Stewart.
The fake spike. Yeah. That's a good one.
The fake spike was good too. Yeah. That was Marino at the Met. Wasn't Pete Carroll the coach of the Jets? Is that right? Yeah. It was Pete Carroll's 1 year, because Pete Carroll, they started like 6-5, and that play set off like a 5-game losing streak that wound up getting Pete Carroll fired. And the whole thing was, people thought Pete was like lazy or not focused on his job because he would play pickup basketball with his coaches like during their downtime.
I think in the media too, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Was the media involved in those games?
Yeah, I think I heard some good old stories about that.
I wonder if there's like any
pick
tape
and roll
floating
against
around.
Pete Carroll. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd pay $50, $100 to get a hold of tapes.
You know? That'd be some good archive material.
You see like Rich Cimini and like Cannizzaro out there, like
Bob Glauber.
Bob Glauber will be the one like slapping the floor, like you know.
So, he does look like Tom Crean. So.
Yeah, he sure does. And a young Bob Glauber then too.
Full of life.
Relatively.
Right. Bobby football.
All right. Connor, news item number two?
Yeah. The Raiders fired Reggie McKenzie on Monday in just an absolutely stunning move, ending the former executive of the year's 7-year run as Oakland GM. The team announced that they plan on hiring a front office executive to replace him.
That was the most sarcastic news read we've had all season.
That was actually news item number three, by the way. That's on me because we have
We got the numbers mixed up.
Yeah, yes. The Miami Miracle.
Miami Miracle. And
I don't want to call it that, but that's the easiest way to say it. And then this one.
I have a few thoughts, as I'm sure you guys know. But I think that
interesting, Connor. Where do you stand on the Raiders rebuild? I'm not sure that we have covered this.
One of the things that I was thinking about on the way here, and I think it was Steve Weiss from NFL Network that made a good point, that we're down to one African-American in the NFL that holds the title of GM, two if you count Doug Williams.
Right, it'd be Chris Greer, right?
Chris Greer and Doug Williams. To hire Gruden in the first place, I mean, the Raiders made a mockery of the Rooney Rule process in subverting a lot of that, admitting that they wanted John Gruden for 2 years and then bringing in T. Martin for a sham interview. I wonder, you know, as much as this is in the vein of what Al Davis, the showman in Al Davis, how disappointed he would be at just sort of what's becoming of the other part of his legacy, which was always, you know, hiring minority coaches, having a female high-powered executive in their organization, stuff that really kind of bolstered, you know, his reputation in the league and among coaches and among players. And this teardown that they're allowing to happen, I feel like, while certainly Raiders-esque, I think is losing a big part of what made Oakland Oakland back in the day.
I think this was destined to happen this way.
Yeah.
Like, I think the whole thing, but I think I'm going even further back than just the last few days. Like, Mark Davis I think we've talked about this. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if he had like a poster of John Gruden in like an old like half zip starter jacket on his wall. You know, like that, like he like all like borderline idolizes John Gruden. And so, like, I think whenever John Gruden came available, Mark Davis was going to move heaven and earth to get him. And that's exactly what happened. And so you knew Gruden was eventually going to get back into coaching. And I think if Gruden wanted to go to Oakland, like, then he was going to be the Raiders head coach. So that's the first part of it. The second part of it is that John Gruden is going to have an idea of how he wants to set it up, how he wants to structure it. And unfortunately for Reggie McKenzie, that meant like that meant it couldn't be set up the way it had been before. And if he was going to stay there, it was going to be in a lesser role, and we saw that. And I think, you know, you knew from the minute Gruden started crapping all over his roster, like, that this was not going to work. And so, I mean, this is, like, to me, it's just, this is a gigantic gamble on John Gruden. And it was bound to happen this way. I don't think that there was any way around it. If you're a Raiders fan, just the minute John Gruden became available, Mark Davis was going to try to get him. And if Gruden wanted to coach in Oakland, he was going to be there. And so now we see if it can work. I think there's certainly room to be skeptical about it based on what happened to the roster in Tampa at the end.
Yeah, that and the fact that, you know, the players they traded away. I mean, even though McKenzie got good value, you know, he people at the time thought, you know, what he got for Amari Cooper was insane, but he held fast to it and got what he thought, because he believed in those players. He drafted them. He knew that they had value. And then you see how they're impacting each of their teams. And it's just like, you know, as soon as Gruden got up to his press conference on Sunday and addressed the report that, you know, McKenzie was on his way out the door and said no comment. I mean, that was a crazy response. I mean, that was like, you know, wow.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, imagine hearing that on the other end. He didn't lie.
I appreciate him not lying.
And that's fair. I agree with that, because a lot of times you get lies in those situations. But imagine being McKenzie, and then I just feel like, you know, at that point, you know, you can't even go forward at all.
I'm sure he was pretty prepared for it. I mean,
yeah. I mean, of course, it's been headed in that direction, but I don't know. That just, you know, that stood out on Sunday.
I mean, I think that there are two sides to it, too, when it comes to Reggie, which is Reggie, like, inherited a incredibly difficult situation. The cap was a disaster. They didn't have draft picks. I mean, it was as bad as it gets. And to his credit, he hit on some high picks. Like, he hit on Amari Cooper. He hit on Khalil Mack. He hit on Derek Carr. And having those three, I mean, you could argue for a time was probably as strong a nucleus of, like, mid-20s stars as anyone had in the league. I think the issue they had is that he didn't. There were certainly problems outside of those three picks, and so you can look at it both ways. You can say he cleaned up the mess and he put stars on the team. The other way to look at it is the problems around those stars were such where it was going to be hard to pay those guys and create a window where we were going to be able to maximize their primes. And that's sort of the catch-22 they caught themselves in. I think Reggie deserves a lot of credit for modernizing that place and for changing the way they scout, changing the way they look at players, and then going and drafting stars. You know, but the flip side of it is that, I mean, you see the holes that they had on the roster, and it's the last 2 years, I think, that some of that stuff's come to roost as, and this is part of it, as the offensive line got older.
But how many teams, well, this is kind of part of a different point, but how many teams are as imperfect as the Raiders were? Let's assume that Derek Carr was healthy that season, that they made the playoffs,
right,
and they lost in the first round. How many teams with that core of player, that those guys could probably go deep into the playoffs? I think that it's a legitimate, if you give another coach that, if you gave Reggie a chance to maybe get another defensive coordinator in there or something, you know, I feel like that's one thing, but you know, that's kind of a tangent. But the one point that I thought was interesting here is how many times Mark Davis has gone to bat for John Gruden already. He's blamed the Khalil Mack trade on himself and not John Gruden. He's now blaming the firing of Reggie McKenzie on himself and not Gruden. And, you know, it's amazing that, you know, a lot of owners just let their football operation exist in that way. But he's being such a sponge for Gruden's, you know, teardown of this place. You know, he's taking on all the responsibility. He's saying that, yeah, it was my idea to get rid of Khalil Mack. It was my idea to get rid of Reggie McKenzie. I mean, what if this doesn't work? You know, you have six more years, you know, say 2 or 3 years down the line, you're still in last place, so you're second to last place in the division. You have seven more years to pay this guy. Mm-hmm. You're trying to build a fan base in a new place.
Yeah.
We've seen how easy that is for the Chargers
and
the Rams even, and they're good, you know?
The good news, bad news, I think, here on that, Derek Carr is playing a lot better. And I know a lot of people aren't paying attention to that. I think Gruden can still coach. Like, I think he absolutely can still coach, and I think he's showing he can still coach.
But admittedly, because Gruden backed off, they had a meeting and he said, "Stop letting me bother you." I mean, how many coaches have to do that?
We can't trust his ability to build a team, because when he was given all the power in Tampa,
or mentor a quarterback,
right? I mean, I think Derek Carr needed somebody to be hard on him, and I think you're starting to see some of the benefits there.
The other good news is that starter jackets are on their way back, which is a nice segue into our next topic.
Yes,
because
yes.
Patrick Mahomes is a fan of the starter jacket. And our next topic is that the Chiefs and Chargers beat the Ravens and Bengals respectively on Sunday, setting up a Thursday night showdown on Arrowhead that could determine the winner of the AFC West. It's a bummer that Melvin Gordon is not, sounds like he may not be able to be available for this game. It is also a bummer that this game is on a Thursday night. Yep. Honestly, yeah. Because you know you
want to get the best out of them.
You want to get the you want to see this. These are two fantastic teams. It's a really interesting matchup. The last time they played was Week One, which seems ages ago, and you get the short week, and you know all of the advantages of the being at home on the short week. So the Chiefs definitely have the upper hand here, just situationally. But, I mean, I'm really excited for this game because I think these are the two most interesting teams in the AFC.
Yeah, I will say big-time credit to Jenny, who has been talking of this matchup for a couple weeks now.
Yep.
And a lot of us, you know, in the middle of the season that just, you know, handed the Chiefs the number AFC one
West.
Seed and the
yeah.
AFC West. And Jenny has been the one person saying, look out for the Chargers. And I think that we're going to see maybe something totally, you know, you play around with the playoff machine enough, and you know, the Kansas City Chiefs could be the 5 seed.
Well, and they're capable AFC. Of, like, the Chargers, like, that style of play that we talked about. Now, obviously, not having Gordon, not having Eckler hurts. But the Chargers are a team that's capable because they've got a veteran quarterback, because they've got a good offensive line. Justin Jackson's a capable back. Like, I don't think he's great, but he's capable.
Which is a side plug. If you have any advice if I should play Justin Jackson or James White for my ensuing fantasy matchup, we want to hear from you.
I think it's interesting because it's like they're capable of playing the sort of style that we were talking about off the top, you know, like where they can slow things down and they can sort of turn it into more of a fight, you know? And if the Chiefs are in that environment, all of a sudden, how do they react to that? You know, if the Chiefs go 3 and out a couple of times and the Chargers are stringing together 12 play drives, I mean, the Chiefs defense hasn't really been stopping anybody anyway, but like what happens to the Chiefs defense then? It's just, I think that and this is a credit to Anthony Lynn, who absolutely subscribes to the Bill Parcells school of coaching. They're very, very capable of playing a style of play that can slow down a team like the Chiefs.
Well, it's interesting. You know, on Sunday Night Football, I did not realize that. I think Collinsworth pointed it out that the Chargers are the slowest offense, that they take the most time between plays. And it's interesting because they can score in a second, right? We've seen those drives from Phillip Rivers where he launches a deep pass to like
receivers.
Tyrell Williams or Keenan Allen or something. And yeah, he's got all these receivers that they can score quickly, but they also have been doing that to slow the pace down just in terms of, you know, the pace at which the offense is operating. And so I agree. I think that, you know, they do have the ability to slow down. And they have a lot of, you know, really good talent on defense. Derwin James has been such a perfect fit for that scheme. And, you know, just watching him is, you know, there was a play that I saw one of the Chargers team reporters had posted where Derwin James just flew out of the backfield. And I mean, he has
he's a unicorn. Like, he can do all kinds of different things.
Yeah.
Like, he's interesting, too, because he was, like, the guy that fell in the draft because – and I know a lot of people – like, a lot of teams have gotten killed for him, not for how he fell. But, I mean, it was really – he was great as a freshman. He got hurt as a sophomore. He wasn't quite the same as a junior, he declared. You know what I mean? Like, it's simple. And so you've got this player who's really probably a top-five talent, another top-five talent, Joey Bosa up front.
Mm-hmm.
Good linebackers, good interior line. Like, they should be able to match up with the Chiefs.
Who you got?
I want to pick the Chargers. I really do. If it was in L.A., should I just do it? Just pull the trigger on it?
I want
just
you.
Just charge leave.
Yeah,
charge leave.
Charge leave. I want to pick them. I just, like, Arrowhead's a tough place, you know?
You know, one of the Chargers players, I'm working on a story that I'll come out later this week, but he was saying that they like playing on the road, and that's probably because their home stadium isn't much of a home thing.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's necessarily the same dynamic of a team going on the road, because like they kind of like it.
The percentage is probably the same as it was for the opener, right? The percent of Chiefs fans there is probably the same as it was.
Yeah, I will say, I mean, you know, I agree that I would say that of all the stadiums I've been to, I think I'm still like five or six away from checking them off my bucket list, but Arrowhead was probably the best opposing fan atmosphere that I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah.
in a road stadium. I thought that was, and I think at that time it was like some punchless, winless Jets team that I was out there with, you know, or Giants team, I can't remember, but this team is just incredible. I mean, they've played on the road for 14 weeks now, you know, and I think that at this point, I think things just don't matter if you're clicking the way that they are.
So, yeah.
I got the Chargers.
Jenny?
Take the Chargers.
We're charged up.
All right. Connor, news item number five.
Sorry, I'm just reading about who our next United States chief of staff is going to be. So I was a little sidetracked here. The Cowboys outlasted the Eagles, scoring in overtime to open up a 2-game lead in the NFC East. Dallas can clinch the division title with a win or an Eagles loss on Sunday. I've enjoyed these last few weeks, all the chaos playoff scenarios for NFC East fans. I've seen people manipulating the playoff machine to get the Giants in as the sixth seed. I don't think that's necessary. I picked the Eagles to win the division. I stuck with that on this podcast 2 weeks ago and doubled down on that, but the Cowboys aren't giving it up. I mean, they're playing incredible football right now, and I think that it's hard to bet against them.
And Amari Cooper's made a difference, no doubt, right? Like, we all know that. It's made a difference for Zeke. It's made a difference for Dak, all of that. Their defense, like, and the way the young players, like Jalen Smith's one of the best stories in the league. Leighton Vander Esch has been awesome as a rookie. DeMarcus Lawrence looks like a premier pass rusher right now. They've had like a lot of, it feels like they've had like a lot of young guys grow up at once. Like a lot of young guys come of age at once. Listen to this, okay? The Eagles' first seven possessions on Sunday. Seven plays, 36 yards. Three plays, minus 1 yard. Three plays, 8 yards. Four plays, 27 yards. Three plays, 1 yard. Five plays, 19 yards. And then the seventh was one play, 2 yards. That was a touchdown. But, I mean, that's three quarters of just completely choking out the Philadelphia Eagles. The week after, you did something similar to the New Orleans Saints.
Cowboys got a little bump from the Zebras, though, on that one, too. That Dallas Goedert offensive pass interference was egregious.
But that's outside. That's outside of the seven
Malcolm
possession.
Malcolm Jenkins had a great line about the refs that they or you know, the officiating center in New York should stay off the bottle. Did you hear that?
Yeah. He might be hearing from New York.
It might be the cost of an expensive bottle that he will be funding there. Yeah. But you know, I agree, and I think Chris Richard has
done
brought
a great job.
A
yeah,
he should be
in the mix for high head coaching jobs.
Yeah,
here in a
it's
weeks.
Hard to imagine he won't get a bunch of interviews.
Yeah, I mean, he's made a huge difference, and I think part of it, like, that could have been an awkward situation with Rob Marinelli having been there, but you know, they gave basically third down's yours. You're going to set up the pass defense. Third down's yours, and I think that, you know, Marinelli deserves credit to being open to bringing in new ideas, because he very easily could have been very set in his ways. And again, I mean, you know, we kill Jerry sometimes for playing GM and all of that. Like, you got to give Jerry, Steven, Will McClay, the guys in the personnel department, credit, because, like, that defense without – I mean, is there a guy who – I don't know that they've got, like, a top 15 pick on that defense, right? Like, DeMarcus Lawrence is a second rounder. Leighton Vander Esch was, like, the 19th or 20th pick. Mm-hmm. Jalen Smith was a second rounder. Awuzie, I believe, was a second or a third rounder. Byron Jones was a late first rounder. Like, they have put together like a high-end defense, like a top five deep defense, without like a single, like, we're talking about like the Chargers, like, they have Joey Bosa, you know.
Right.
You talk about the Bears, they have Khalil Mack. He was the fourth pick in the draft. Leonard Floyd was a high first rounder. Mm-hmm. Like, they put together
Smith.
Huh?
Roquan Smith,
10 pick. And so, like, that's the amazing thing about the Cowboys, is they put together this defense, and there really aren't, like, I don't think there's a single, like, top half of the first round pick in there.
Did you guys know that Chidobe Awuzie's nickname is Cheeto Clamps?
I heard Cheeto. I hadn't heard Cheeto clamps. Clamps is that's
Cheeto
fantastic.
Clamps. It's in the first line. It's in the first five
like
words.
Clamps,
of his,
like clamping down
like
receivers.
Clamping
right?
down. Yeah, it's in the first five words of his Wikipedia bio.
Wow.
Cheeto clamps.
Cheeto like clamps. That. So maybe sort of a bless him branding.
Could
push
you like?
There.
Could you like come like have T-shirts with like Chester Cheetah on it with like
Cheeto clamps.
like Chester Cheetah with clamps.
Connor clamps.
Would that work?
I like that.
I'm a big fan of Chester Cheetah.
Cheeto clamps. Jenny clamps. That would be Albert clamps. Albert clamps.
Albert clamps.
That sounds like a science teacher.
Albert clamps.
Yeah. I love where the Cowboys are at. I think that they're in position now. Like again, like, and I think that that's what's so, going to be so interesting about the NFC bracket, right?
Yeah.
Like is like. But like right now, it looks like it's amazing that the Cowboys they can clinch the division in Week 15. They were 3-5. They can clinch the division with 2 weeks to go, and all they need they just need a win or an Eagles loss. It's simple. Like they just their magic number, I guess, would be one, right? So you've got like Dallas winning its division home game in the wild card round, Chicago winning its division home game in the wild card round, which means we could have like those contrasting styles in both. NFC divisional games.
There's a great defensive counterweight in both divisions. There's a couple great defensive counterweights in both divisions. I think the Texans and the Cowboys in the AFC, and then you have the Bears, you have the Seahawks, and potentially the Vikings in the NFC. So there's a lot of...
Chargers, I think.
Chargers, a lot of good pitfalls for these high-powered offenses, which I think is fun.
Should be interesting. Okay, so I guess we got to make this one kind of quick, Connor, but... We're going to adjust this. Actually, Jenny's fantasy update now featuring Connor Orr, right?
Because he's you know, we're sort of on the same side now, essentially. But I think, you know, Connor had some roster moves planned this week.
Yeah. Obviously.
It's like business is being
business
done.
Business is, you know, sending a message to his team for next season that, you know, you play till the end.
Yeah. You know, I don't want to speak too much because Jenny's the voice of the team, and I'm just lucky to be on board. But... I will do anything and everything I can to ensure that we come home with a W at the end of this. So I'm very excited to I'm reinvigorated. I'm Hugh Jackson. I'm still employed, which is
so
good.
She's Marvin Lewis.
I hope I'm not the Bengals in this analogy.
Yeah. What's a good
hopefully Connor doesn't have the same effect on your
Josh
team.
Josh McDaniels maybe.
You know,
coming home.
Yeah, maybe. You know, my team is right now is kind of like the Chargers, getting hot late in the season.
Nice.
So you know, we'll see what happens. But I've got that big decision at running back, so I'm taking some input. You know,
we're going to do some
analytics. It's Justin Jackson or
James White. Yeah, which, I mean, I've got Barkley as my
James
running
White's
back one.
Tough. Like Patriot skill players are. Like I try my. I've had Gronk on my team a couple times. Like I try to stay away from Patriot skill players just because. They're always liable to have like the week where they've got 5 yards and you're up the creek.
It's true.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm starting half the Chargers offense already, so it might be better to diversify a little bit.
I actually benefited from this week's top news because the Vikings, the chaos on the offensive side of the ball. My game came down. I had a 30-point lead going into Monday night. They had that. My opponent had Cousins and Cook. And I had Diggs, and I just held on. I just held on and won by 7, so I advanced to the semifinals. And that will put you – are you semifinals?
I had a bye, yeah.
Semifinals.
So I'm a little bit worried about that, you know, coming off the
complacency?
Bye. Yeah, I'm just – you know, I went to – you know, my team went to Mexico, and I'm a little bit afraid that it's the 2000 –
like the old Jason Witten.
Yeah, like the Cowboys.
Bobby Carpenter.
Yeah, I mean, a couple
Mark
of the
Colombo.
Players were in Cabo, and I just feel like this portends poorly.
Hopefully the Simpson family wasn't there.
Yikes.
Yeah. All right, guys. All right, emergency update. I use Simpson just to be clear, crystal clear here. We were referencing the 2008 Cowboys to Cabo trip. That was during the divisional. That was during their playoff bye before they played the Giants and lost. And I was not referencing a certain former Hertz pitch man. I was referencing Joe Simpson and Jessica Simpson, but you took it a different way.
The Jessica Simpson thing, I don't know. That must
you don't
have just
anything
went,
against her.
No,
you know?
She's great. Didn't that, know? That didn't just know, went right did, over my head.
Did OJ have some sort of connection to Cabo? I think
I know that I mean, he's got the funds to vacation, or had the, at some point in the mid-2000s. So I was sitting there.
Maybe
like,
it says something about you that you thought immediately about.
Yeah,
like I was
no, it's true. Yeah.
So when Connor said yikes, he thought this was an O.J. Simpson reference rather than
like,
the
what
Jessica
what a weird
Simpson
way to close
family.
The podcast like an errant O.J. Simpson reference. Jesus. But apparently it's not. So you can all go. You can all go home now.
Joe Simpson is a different type of, we'll just get out here. Different type of Simpson. All right, that's enough about O.J. Simpson. I want to tell you guys about a couple of products, one that I consume, the other I've seen my friends consume to great effect. First, we're going to tell you about Omaha Steaks, and I love a good steak, right? Like, and to be able to get it in the mail, not have to go to the supermarket, to be able to avoid looking for a parking spot this time of year in a supermarket parking lot, to avoid having to drive and drive there and back, battle traffic. You guys know what it's like this time of year. It's fantastic. So you can check that box off. You want some steaks in your fridge, some steaks in your freezer. Omaha Steaks, a great place to get it without all the hassle that you normally go through. And so right now, Omaha Steaks is giving you even more reason to do this. This is an amazing limited time offer to my listeners. When you go to omahasteaks.com, enter the code JINGLE, that's JINGLE like Jingle Bells, into the search bar. And here's what you're going to get. 4 hand-cut, aged-to-tenderness, top sirloin steaks, 2 savory premium pork chops, 4 chicken-fried steaks, 4 Omaha Steaks burgers, 4 snappy kielbasa sausages, all beef meatballs, 4 perfectly browned potatoes au gratin, 4 made-from-scratch caramel apple tartlets, and on top of all of that, here's your bonus, you get 4 more burgers for free. Omaha Steaks is a fifth-generation family-owned company with over 100 years of experience delivering perfectly aged beef, hand-cut by master butchers in Omaha. All beef is USDA inspected for quality and exceeds standards. Order with confidence. Omaha Steaks is America's original butcher. Again, get this limited-time package for only $49.99 when you go to omahasteaks.com, type JINGLE into the search bar, and add the family gift package to your cart. Don't wait. This offer ends soon. Go to omahasteaks.com, type JINGLE into the search bar to send the Omaha Steaks family gift package today. And the second thing I'm going to tell you guys about, and again, this is sort of for guys, right? Like the same way the steaks, not that I'm saying that you know, my wife loves a good steak, but this is another one that's just for the guys. And you guys all have friends. I have friends that go through losing hair. It sucks, man. It really sucks. And I personally am one of the lucky ones, but I've seen friends go through it. Your confidence, it's important. And sometimes one change can make all the difference. Hair Club knows this, and they're inviting you to become part of their Hair Club family to see how getting the most out of your hair can change your life. They understand the emotions you're feeling and know the questions that you have. Hair Club is the leader in total hair solutions with a legacy of success for over 40 years. Whether you're looking to revitalize the growth of your own hair or to learn more about the latest proven methods for hair replacement or restoration, Hair Club's professionally trained stylists, hair health experts, and consultants will craft a personalized solution to ensure you feel your best and get the most out of your hair. See for yourself just how powerful great hair can be. I can tell you, I've got great hair. the idea of having a full head of hair, I know it's like I know some of us take it for granted, but I've seen what my friends go through. I know that it's not easy when you lose your hair. Some of them shave your head. You don't got to do that, fellas. You can have a full head of hair just like me. So here's what you're going to do. You're going to go to hairclub.com/Breer today for a free hair analysis and a free take-home hair care kit. All of that's valued at over $300. That's hairclub.com/Breer for a free hair analysis and a free hair care kit. Hairclub.com/Breer. Experience your hair and your life at its best only with Hair Club. I'm certain you'll love the club. Then you can have great hair like I have great hair. We're going to jump into the six-pack now. You guys know how this works. Every week I put the call out for questions on Twitter. You ask, I pick 6. If I pick yours, you get a like on Twitter. Like I hit the little heart there. And you get an answer right here on the podcast. Question number 1, this is from Matt Reichel. That's at Matt12R. Should the Philadelphia Eagles draft a running back in the draft or someone from Alabama? Look, I normally think that you can turn over any rock and find a running back, right? Like, this is the way I felt forever about it. I don't think you should. I think unless a guy's Saquon Barkley or Ezekiel Elliott, or Todd Gurley, you probably shouldn't take one in the top 10. And you probably shouldn't take one in the first round, period, because you can find them other places. That said, I think the Eagles do need to address the running back position somewhere in the draft. It's clear they missed what they had last year with Jay Ajayi and LeGarrette Blount. If you talk to coaches who've worked against them, they can see how the dynamic of the offense works. Well, why is that? So much of what the Eagles did last year, they were doing a lot of stuff with RPOs. They were doing a lot of stuff off the quarterback runs, a lot of stuff off the option game. And having effective running backs unlocks all of that. And so they've really missed the presence that they had in the running game last year. It really helped them manage Carson Wentz. It helped them manage Nick Foles when he got into the lineup. And so the dynamic's different this time. Doesn't mean they got to take one in the first round. I don't think there's one in the 19 class that's going to be worth going in the first round, but they do have to address it somewhere. And so your point's well taken, Matt Reichel. The Eagles should draft a running back somewhere. Question number two from Bobby Carpenter. That's my old buddy. Former Ohio State and Cowboys linebacker Bobby Carpenter. We just actually referenced him when we were talking about the Cowboys Cabo trip in January of 2008. Bobby asks, is John Harbaugh going to coach the Ravens or the Jets next season? Bobby, I want to say that it's probably going to be the Ravens now. It's hard to say where. It's hard for me to look at it right now and say the Ravens would get rid of him even if he made the playoffs. And I think he's got a legit shot to make the playoffs. I'm not positive this won't be a mutual parting anyway. And so I think it's certainly possible that Harbaugh could wind up coaching somewhere else in 2019, even if they make the playoffs. I know that sounds crazy. I don't think they'll fire him. I do think that they'll, in that case, there may be some sort of mutual parting. I think the amount of empty seats there are in Baltimore, there have been the last couple months in Baltimore, play into this. If I'm them, I'm looking at this whole thing and I'm saying, God, if we let John Harbaugh go, he's going to be the number one coach in the market and he's going to be snapped up like this. And I think there's a rational way to look at it. I do wonder if there are some people there maybe feel like the whole thing's run its course. I do think the Jets would be in it too if Harbaugh comes available. Question number three from Chucky is back. That's at Raider_Chucky. What candidates are on the list of possibilities to replace Raiders or former Raiders GM Reggie McKenzie? I haven't come up with a great list of names yet. I know Jimmy Ray's name has been out there a little bit. I know Chris Polian's name's been out there a little bit. I think this is going to be somebody with some level of experience and somebody who's got the capabilities of pushing back against John Gruden. And I thought it was interesting, the phrasing, too. They said front office executive doesn't necessarily mean that it will be a traditional general manager. And so there are lots of moving pieces there, but I think one thing that you can count on is that it will be somebody capable of pushing back on John Gruden. Could that be Mark Domenech? I think it's a fair question. Maybe somebody like that. I think you certainly could see somebody getting their second chance as a general manager brought in to run the personnel side for John Gruden. And I think it would be preferable to have somebody who has some experience having worked with him. Like one name that would make sense to me would be Scott McLuhan, who worked with John Gruden in Green Bay and who has a brother that works in the organization. That would make some sense to me. Question number four. This is from Chacos O'Reilly XP. That's at Chacos _O'Reilly. Other than the Browns and Packers, which teams do you think will be looking for a new head coach this offseason? So the Browns are in the mix. The Packers are in the mix. I'll take you guys through the list right now because I know you guys love this stuff. Okay, Cowboys, I'd say Jason Garrett is now safe because my belief is they're going to win the division. You look at the NFC North. I do not think there will be a change in the NFC North, the NFC South. I think the Falcons will have some staff changes. I don't think that Dan Quinn is going anywhere. Ron Rivera, I would put up in the air right now. The owner's reputation has been for being volatile in the past. He wants a cutting-edge organization. It's a little older school there now. I think the Carolina situation is up in the air. I know there are some worried people there. I think Tampa's gone. I think Arizona's up in the air. In the AFC West, I think Denver remains up in the air. In the AFC South, I would say I wouldn't have told you Doug Marrone would be in trouble a couple of weeks ago. I think that is now up in the air. AFC North, you mentioned the Browns. They're obviously going to be looking for a coach. The Bengals, I think, would maybe be in play. I'd probably lean more towards them keeping Marvin Lewis, and then the one team in the AFC East would be the Jets. The over-under on changes, I would say, I would set probably right there at like 7-5. And we mentioned the Ravens, of course, as a potential place where there would be a change. Question number five, Neil Goldberg, at Neil MSBGC. How desirable is the Jets' head coaching job, poor ownership in GM, along with tough media, but young, promising quarterback and $100 million in cap space? Plus, if you ever won there, look out. The pluses and minuses are both huge. How does the league see this job? I think the league sees this job as a favorable one. I think part of it is going to depend on what the structure is going forward. What is Mike Maccagni's role? Is the head coach going to report to him? Is the head coach going to have power over the 53? Is the head coach going to have say-so on draft day? There are lots of questions that I think will determine how coaches will look at this job, but I don't think the roster's in as bad shape as a lot of people think. I think you've got some really, really nice buildings, really, really nice building blocks, and Sam Darnold and Leonard Williams and Jamal Adams and Marcus May. So there is something to work with there. And all of those guys are young. All those guys are, I believe, 25 or younger. And so you've got a group there that you can build around, and you're going to have a high pick, and you're going to have all that cap space. And so I think it is a desirable job for the right person who's willing to deal with everything that goes along with working in New York. Finally, question number six. This is from Garbillion at Garbillion. Also, what's next for Greg Williams after the Browns? Do you see him with a job in the league next year? Yes, I think he's done a good enough job where he's going to have a job somewhere in the league next year. I think it's certainly possible that a new head coach in Cleveland keeps him on. I think that there's a possibility he's a defensive coordinator somewhere else. I do not think he's the next head coach of the Browns, though. So for whatever it's worth, that's where I'm at on that. Appreciate you guys coming out, as always, and supporting the podcast. You guys can do that by leaving us a review and rating on iTunes. That helps the... And Harry over here, he's explained this to me, that helps the algorithm, helps us with where we're at in the rankings and all that different stuff. So be sure to do that. Leave us a rating and a review. And always, always, always feel free to send me your feedback. We want to make this your podcast. You can make us better. You can get me on Twitter at Albert Breer, on Facebook at Albert R. Breer, on Instagram at Albert_Breer. And remember always to listen to this podcast, the MMQB Gambling Podcast, the podcast that Andy and Gary are doing twice a week, which is also fantastic. You guys can get us and them all in one feed, the MMQB NFL podcast feed, at Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, wherever you guys get your shows. Week 15 on its way. Same time next week. We'll be wrapping that up. We'll see you guys then.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.